generous introduction from a guy who became the first disciple that I ever worked with when I was 19 or 18 years old. And Howard Hendricks challenged me when he was in town earlier that year, speaking on the master plan of evangelism. My parents had some connection to him, so they took me out to dinner with Howard Hendricks, who's coming here next year. That'll be interesting. And I had been so impressed with his teachings on discipleship and how God could move the world through a process of discipleship, and that was the method that Christ chose when he was here, forsaking the multitudes, holding to his disciples because he knew that men were his method. And Howard Hendricks must have heard that I was teaching some Bible studies in the area, so he started talking to me on one side at one point during dinner, and I said, this is a great concept you've laid out. I'm just really excited about this. He says, well, Dennis, if I came back in a year or two, would there be a little Dennis here? And I thought, yeah, maybe there will. So I started looking around for a guy that would be interested in spiritual growth. And I went through a few guys that didn't seem too serious about it. I finally found this guy who had received Christ some months before. And I pitched him on it. I said, how would you like to study together and try to, you know, learn how to grow in the Lord? And he was into it. Began to get together and read. He became a voracious reader. And before long, he also started teaching the Word. And of course, he has, in the subsequent years, has planted numerous home churches, has himself discipled numerous other people who themselves are now discipling others. And all in all, it accounts for, I'm sure, thousands of people before all is said and done. Which I think if you know, that's the way discipleship works. You don't see a lot right at first, but for an 18-year-old kid to reach thousands of people for Christ, that's pretty good. And that's the way I like to look at it. Good year of ministry. I'd like to change the subject that was announced for tonight on leadership team building. We'll still get to that if we get a chance. We'll just see how this goes. But I thought I would speak instead on this subject, toward a leader-rich church. Every church has its strengths and its weaknesses. And we certainly have our weaknesses here, believe me. You have to remember, those of you who are our guests here this week, that we kind of have the best foot forward right now. If you hung around here very long, you would see a lot of problems in this church. And so we don't consider ourselves to be in any special category in that sense at all. But we also have our strengths, and one thing that all visitors here who study our church comment on is how they want to know, how do you get all of these people interested in leadership, and how do you cause them to be motivated to put out so much energy and effort to equip themselves and to become really good leaders? We have on our servant team here about 650 adults who have all undergone a fairly rigorous training. They've all demonstrated their validity as leaders by leading people to Christ, by winning people into discipleship relationships, by leading cell groups and home churches. And that's really the treasure of our church, is that we have all of these really quality, devoted leaders. So we get asked that. How do you do that? And we kind of feel like, well, that's a good question. Don't really know. But I've been thinking about it, and so I thought I would share with you tonight seven things that struck me that would be helpful in developing an environment where you'll probably become rich in leaders. I have a couple of assumptions that I'm working from that are basically shared assumptions in our church. One is that the New Testament church beats out subsequent paradigms. We're a group that got sold early on the idea of the primitive church, the church in Acts as a movement of God, and we're drawn to that picture of the church much more so than we were the established church in our own day. In fact, we came from a cultural subgrouping that really didn't fit in to the institutional church, so we were almost compelled to develop something different. And so our home Bible studies, which have grown into Xenos, grow out of that conviction. Another assumption we have is that we're not interested in competing with other believing churches for their members. A lot of churches grow that way. I had one authority in church growth come by last year, and he had statistics to back up his claim, he said, that 95% of church growth in the U.S. is nothing but members transferring from other churches. And he wanted to elaborate how he got that number and stuff, but I don't think that's important. I don't even know whether that's a true number or not, but obviously there's a lot of that that goes on. And frankly, if you wanted to build your church based on competing with area churches so that people come by and decide, I'd rather come to this church than the other church, you would probably take a completely different direction than the one I'm suggesting to you tonight. It would probably be important to get the best show going you could and invest huge dollars in, you know, all kinds of very impressive things for the worship service, because that's what people want, and that's how you win in the church competition battle. We're not interested in that. Our field of mission is the world and the lost only. Of course, we have some Christians that come here from other churches, and it's all right. They can come if they don't get in any trouble. But we're not here for them, and they're not the ones that we seek after. So if they come, if people come from other churches, we let them know you're welcome to come in and grab an oar and start to pull. Now, those given, let's think through seven different conditions that tend to promote leadership in the local church. The first has to do with vision, that the church believes that qualified new leaders are the final key to success. Not just that we need leaders, which every church feels that, but that getting leaders raised up is the key for us. That is the one thing that we really trust in to win the war of which we're a part. A lot of churches, by their actions, show that this is not really what they believe, because they want to see leaders raised up, but the effort going into that project is negligible compared to the effort going into their other main projects, which is clearly what they trust in to move the church forward. This is tied up with the whole theology of distributed ministry. Whether we believe that ministry should center in the top leadership and the staff of the church, or whether it should be distributed out, and that the church grows with the growth from God when it's supplied by the proper working of each individual joint and ligament, each individual part. It's the same thing that we read about in Ephesians 4:11, where God gave apostles, prophets, teachers, evangelists, and pastors for the equipping of the saints for the work of service or ministry to the building up of the body of Christ. This type of passage, which captured our attention and faith early on, has always animated our church. We don't think that the leaders are here to do ministry. The leaders are here to facilitate the membership to carry forward the ministry of the church. And for that, we need leaders. The top leadership and staff in a church that wants to be leader rich first need to preach and teach leadership. That leadership is of God, that God uses human agents to motivate other people and to guide people into a richer life with Christ, to galvanize a group of people to become effective in outreach. God uses leaders for that. And so the top leadership of the church has to constantly be keeping this before the people, that maybe you should think about being a leader. And particularly from things that I'm going to explain later on, we're not hesitant to preach this to the entire congregation, because we believe that most of our people could be leaders if they wanted to be. Also, the top leadership needs to define legitimate spiritual leadership. What is it? And so we need to be preaching servant leadership. We need to be preaching against the spirit of the Gentiles, as Jesus called it, the desire to lord it over other people. And we need to be teaching that leadership is nothing but getting under more people to serve them. And, you know, if you're under one other person, serving that person, we don't call it a leader. But when you're serving a number of people, we call that a leader. And you would see that in this church very often. Also, that the leadership has to be defined in terms of what the character of a leader needs to be and what the function of a leader needs to be. And these, of course, are taught to us in the Scripture. So if we're teaching expository teaching and New Testament teaching and old, we'll see principles of spiritual leadership often brought up in the Bible, and we should declare those and call people directly into leadership. The top leadership needs to refuse to fill the leadership vacuum. As pastors and leaders, we all the time have people coming to us saying, "Oh my God, we've got a problem over here. And, you know, so-and-so is doing this, and we got a fight going over here, and this other couple are in the sack again," and so on it goes. And our reaction has to be pretty consistent. "Yeah, that is a problem. What are you going to do about it?" "Well, we think you should come over. We need you over here." "No, you don't need me. I'll tell you what, let's sit down and I'll give you some advice if you wanted," or something like that. "I'm not going to come over there. That's your group. You're going to take care of that." And so there is constant pressure. Often we chide the clergy in the church today for a clergy-laity mentality. We think the clergy have put themselves up above the laity. Often it's the laity that have pushed them up there. They want them up there. And so there has to be some fiber on the part of the leadership of the church to refuse to step in, to give people the tools, but insist that they take care of their own problems and minister to their own flock. The top leadership of the church need to measure their own success by new leadership development. That's something we do as a church. Whether it's the elders, whether it's any one of the divisions of the church, when we come to our annual time of assessing how are we doing here, the question that's coming up in one group after another, "So how's the leadership development coming over there? Who are the people that are coming up? Who are you going to give us this year?" When our consultants talk to home group leaders, that's their question. "How are you doing with leadership development?" Every time. So this is constantly before us. No one's allowed to consider themselves successful just because they can do a good ministry if they're not delivering us other leaders who can do it instead of them. Our spending as a church, our hiring, the availability of our top people, and the airtime all reflect the priority that we place. How important do we really think it is that we raise up more leaders in this church? You can determine those by looking at all of these things. How much spending is going into leadership development in the church? I like to study church budgets, and sometimes it's almost impossible to discern any dollars going into leadership development. People will say, "I don't know how you guys get the time to teach classes. I don't see how you get the time to do all of the discipleship you do," and so forth. Well, that's because we hired people to do that. It's because we decided not to spend it on the other thing, but to spend it on this instead. It's a spending priority. We'll generally sink in our paid efforts to develop leadership, aside from the volunteer work, but in our central effort to assist people in raising up leaders, we'll probably drop between $500,000 to $1 million a year. And that's because we think that our church sinks or swims based on this issue. You know, have you ever seen a group that was better than its leadership? I doubt we'll ever see that. A group will be as good as its leadership and no better. So the more leadership and the better leadership we have, the better church we're going to have. Good leaders draw people. And we're just sold on that strategy. And you can tell it. You know, you talk about airtime. That's a big issue in church. Who gets to make their announcements? Who gets to bother people with their agenda? Leadership development better be in the front of the line. And, of course, there are other things that deserve time there as well, whether it's evangelism, whether it's missions. There's a number of different issues vying for airtime and attention span of people. We need to make sure that leadership development is right there, front and center. So this is all having to do with our vision and whether the church places the development of leaders at the center or whether it's just a side issue. I truly believe a lot of churches feel like, you know, the key for us is we need to get that one celebrity pastor. He could really bring the people in and so forth. That we need to hire this hotshot from him and we'll hire him away from that other church because they don't need him and we need him here and that's going to get us a youth program and that's going to get us the other thing. Well, we just don't believe that. We believe that everything we need is right here. We just need to raise it up. And that's God's will and it's God's way. Secondly, the existing leaders need to insist on Spirit-chosen new leaders. Now, what we mean by this is, first of all, that there's no seniority system. In a lot of unions and so forth, whoever the senior person is gets to step up when somebody vacates a role, then whoever is next in line gets to take that role. That's destructive of true spiritual leadership. Spiritual leadership has to be authentic, and that means that we believe if you study leadership in the Bible, every time there's a spiritual leader, that person was called into that position by God. Jesus said to the disciples, "You didn't choose me, I chose you." And that context of that statement was not salvation. It was not that he called them to salvation, but that he named them as apostles. That's what he was talking about. We see the calling of Moses. We see the calling of David. God says, "I took you out of the field shepherding lambs to be a shepherd of my children Israel." At every point along the way, God always goes to someone and says, "I want you to come and be a leader for me, of my people." So we believe that that's the key to raising up real and authentic leadership that gets the job done, is that we have to try to discern God's work in anointing and choosing a leader. There are numerous signs we could look for that suggest this person is being chosen by God and called up into leadership. And essentially what we're looking for is we're looking for a developing character that reflects a godly lifestyle and godly values. But more than that too, we're also looking for somebody who God is working through that person and blessed causing their ministry to flourish. And essentially, they have a following. God will lift up a leader naturally. If we just supply the food, they rise up. And our task as the central leadership of the church is not to make people leaders, but is to recognize who are leaders. And so in our process, when we bring someone upon our servant team, which is our term for an established leader here, we're recognizing that they're leaders. We wait until that's clear. If someone wants to be a leader, they don't come to the leadership of the church and say, "I want to be a leader." You say, "If you want to be a leader, all you need now is a following." Don't try to talk us into it. We're all for it. Go out and talk some of the heathen people in this city into it, and you'll be in business. So we wouldn't want partiality, personal friendship, admiration of outward characteristics. I remember there have been a whole string of episodes where celebrities have come to Christ, and the next thing you know, they have them teaching Bible, you know, a few months later, leading. I remember when Bob Dylan came to Christ, and he was immediately thrust into the limelight by the people working with him and so forth, and then these people usually fizzle out. That's not God's way. I remember listening to a guy teach when I was a teenager, and he was saying, "We ought to all pray that God would save the Beatles. Because, you know, just think how many people they could lead to Christ." Well, I thought it sounded all right. You know, I don't know, something bothered me about it. But in the years since then, I've realized, you know, that's not the way God works. That's not how he's going to win people, by winning the Beatles. Read your Bible. It isn't the famous. It's like Paul says, not many mighty, not many noble, very few of those. It's just people like you and me. That's all God needs, and his power is adequate. That boy with the 5 loaves and 2 fish, if he could do that with them, he can do whatever he wants with what you got. Well, we need to avoid the turtle on the fence post syndrome. This is where you're out walking in the field and you notice sitting on a fence post is a turtle. And we wonder, what are we to think? Well, one thing's pretty clear. Somebody put him there. He didn't climb up there. And this is the way a lot of Christian leaders feel. They've been placed in their position. They didn't naturally and spiritually develop into it by a process of gradually winning over hearts of people and nourishing others' lives and being a servant that everyone begins to look to for advice and direction. But rather, they've been named to hear the leader of this group. And so, of course, the turtle isn't that happy about being on the fence post either. That's so unnatural. And we want natural, spiritually chosen leaders. Washing the saints' feet should qualify people for leadership more than a master's degree. In a church that wants to be leader rich, put the first things first. And this is what the Bible talks about. Of course, in case you're wondering what that allusion is to, this is referring to Jesus, the greatest leader of all, the greatest rabbi and teacher, on his knees, scrubbing away on the filthy and disgusting feet of his dirty disciples. And he got down and said, that's what leadership is about, is to wash the saints' feet. And so when we look out and try to ask ourselves, where is God going to give us our next leader, we look for who is washing the saints' feet, who is caring for the people of God, who has let the needs of the people of God and of the world around them penetrate their heart, and they're pouring themselves out. That's what qualifies someone. Well, we want some other things too. We'll call on that person to get equipped and get qualified in other ways. But the idea that just being a scholar qualifies you to be a leader, which is a lot of what we see in the American church, where people come out of the seminary and they go to seminary in the first place saying that they have a calling, but that often never having hardly any experience in ministry, really don't know what it is, study their books for 3 years and come out and they're looking for a ministry posting like you would look for a position in a legal firm or a managership in the Pepsi company. And it's all based really on that picture. We operate the church like corporate America. That's not God's way. And we should call on people, and I would say we're not anti-seminary per se, not very strongly anti-seminary anyway. I've been there twice, so I can plead innocence there. That's where the scholarship is, and we want that knowledge. We want scholarship and learning. And we often think that it's the person that's really washed the saints' feet and has shown themselves as a real servant and probably also gifted to teaching. Let's send that person who already has ministry, who is a leader. Now it's time maybe to take their training to the next step. And of course, I also think we should never import leadership from outside the church, probably. Hardly ever. We can't really say that this is a biblical premise, because there's at least one example, and really several in the New Testament, of imported leadership. We see when there was a great spiritual awakening in the city of Antioch, Barnabas and them were so overwhelmed, he went up to Tarsus and fetched Paul to come down and help them with that ministry there. So that's permissible in certain situations like that. If you're like Antioch and you're completely overrun with growth and ministry through a huge influx, maybe there's a case where you might want to go over and see if someone from another church will come and help you. But why do I think this is normally such a bad idea? What does it say to our people when we call on them and say, you can be a servant of God, you can lead for God, and they do so and step forward, but then as soon as a higher level position in our church comes open, no, not you, we're going to get this guy from Tuscaloosa to come in here. What does it say to them? I think it's a devastating message. You're okay for that part. Not for this. For this, we need a pro. And I think it's extremely demotivating. We generally refuse to bring in the outside leader. If we need somebody good, and we don't have anybody good, then whose fault is that? Maybe we should have foreseen this. Maybe we should have gotten some good people raised up. And I think that 99% of the time, that should always be the way we fill any position, is right there out of our own flock. I would hope that if our entire eldership died on a plane flying to California, that not a single person would be hired into this church, that other people would all step up and fill those roles. And I believe that that would happen. There's no need to go anywhere else. Maybe in, I can see Lance Witt's situation, you know, 20,000 people pouring into this church. They probably have a case where they deserve to go get someone else to come and help. But unless your church is like that, I would suggest tell your own people, we need you for this role. And you may have to leave some things undone for a while to create the vacuum that will suck the people up into that role. So that's all to do with existing leaders insisting on Spirit-chosen leaders. Third point, spiritual leaders need to be held in honor, in accountability, and in discipline. What we're saying here in the first place is that we can't allow leadership in the local church to become profane. Profane means commonplace, unimportant. You know, if I was to come into you at your birthday with a little hanky wrapped up and say, I got you something, and you open it up and you're like, it looks like a piece of gravel. You'd be like, yeah, it's really ancient. You'd be like, so what? Right? I don't care about that. There's gravel all over the place. That's not a present. If I gave you a rare gemstone, a precious diamond, that would be a gift. But those are really rare. And that's why they're so expensive. And if diamonds were as common as gravel, they wouldn't be worth anything either. Think about it. And so in the church, I've seen churches where people will lead a group and they feel like they're doing the church a favor. Where they feel like, you know, well, okay, I'll serve for a year, but that's it. And so the whole concept of leadership is like a duty. I guess I have to take my turn. And boy, have we lost it. That's really out of touch there. To be able to lead for God, to be able to be a spokesperson for God, is a rare privilege. That's for the few. That's for the people who have lived themselves into that position. And we have to extol and hold high the concept of spiritual leadership. There are hazards in leadership. It's a more hazardous position than just hanging around. You know, you stand up to lead for God, you're making yourself a target for people with rotten attitudes, a target for the enemy of God is going to single you out because you dared to stand up and say, I'll try to influence others for God. And therefore, just for that alone, we should honor those people. To become a leader ought to be a costly business that costs a lot to become a leader. We should not make it an easy thing. You know, we've talked with churches where we ask them, well, what does it take to be a small group leader? Basically, raise your hand. Show up. That's it. Some of them will say, well, we asked them to go to a weekend seminar. But then it'll even turn out that's optional. In other words, to get into leadership costs nothing. That's profane. And we cannot expect leadership to be something that is thirsted for and admired and modeled in an environment like that. We should stick with the standards given to us in the scriptures. You know, when Paul describes leaders, whether it's the deacons, which is the ministers, the servants, whether it's the elders, read those lists. Those are exacting lists. And he's being very careful that Timothy selects very carefully. We notice in the literature on movements and institutions that institutions tend to try to make their members' lives easy. And when we study the church in America today, we see a lot of this, the church trying to serve their membership and make their life easy. Often in talking to pastors where they have asked us, how do you guys do this and what's your program you're using and so forth, we start to describe some of it. And we start seeing the eyes flinching and getting wider and then the looking down and fidgeting and we're like, what? And you're like, well, you know, our people are really busy here, you know. I don't think we could do that in our church. And the pastor will go on and start making excuses for his people, why none of them have time, and why they're all busy. And that's really the American way, isn't it? We're just busy. Too busy for the things of God. That's not going to lead to a leader-rich church. In movements, they call for sacrifice from their people, unapologetically. Of course you would give your all to this. Of course you would throw yourself 100% into this and view those who are unwilling to do so as really oddballs and really hard to understand what their problem is. That has to be a consensus in the church, that it makes sense to live for God and to give everything you have to living for God. And if you have that consensus built into your church, you'll see leaders rising up. Oh, yes, you will. There'll be no shortage of leaders there. If we ignore the leaders that are out there, they usually start to fizzle. You know, it's the same kind of thing you see in military parlance where they talk about a military, you know, brigade or platoon or whatever that's undisciplined versus one that is disciplined. An undisciplined force in time of war that don't have sharp, snapping discipline as a unit tend to be easily defeated. And that is well-known military doctrine. You have to have a well-disciplined force if you want to overthrow a major foe. And we are facing a major foe. We need a disciplined force, and showing the attention to our leadership force, not just hoping they're doing something good out there, but going out and making certain that they're accountable, that they're continuing to grow, that they're maintaining the standards that they had earlier, causes us to have a disciplined force of leaders, and that will cause the leaders themselves. It's also interesting to note that morale in well-disciplined units tends to be high, but undisciplined units tend to have low morale. And in many churches that we observe, their leadership cadre is an undisciplined rabble. And we have had that problem in our church as well, where our discipline slacked down, and then everybody just starts to crab and grouse and feel dissatisfied. We need to be a disciplined force, even to the point where we remove non-performing, fleshly, and discredited leaders without any hesitation. Well, not, I'm exaggerating. We should have some hesitation. We should try to work with them on the problem. But there are people whose affections for the things of God go south, and they're just not as zealous as they used to be. And they develop attitude problems, and they develop sin problems, and it's time for them to go. It's time for them to step aside at that point. If we don't do that, then the entire cadre of leaders is degraded at that point and defamed and becomes profane. Being a leader becomes a joke at that point. Discipline is crucial. We should publicly honor and extol good leaders for their sacrifice. We started doing something in our church that I'm surprised we never thought about earlier, and I'm surprised other churches haven't thought about it too. Every time that we plant a new home, that one home church plants a new home church, that's a magnificent piece of work there. In our church, that takes a lot to do that. You have to have raised up an entire new leadership team. They have to be qualified according to rigorous criteria. You have to have won as many people as you started out with to begin with, to the Lord. You have to have a complex system of discipleship going in both groups. Both groups have to be apparently viable, believed to be viable. And to pull all of this off in even a few years' work is really a feat. That's really not easy to do. And so every time that one of our home churches does that, what we started doing is we get the whole church together. And this place is jammed in here, right out to the walls. And we bring those people up and stand them up here and have them tell us how they did it and what it was like. And people applaud for them, and it's really a fun night. People just go crazy at this as we recognize the efforts. And then they bring up the new disciples that they're delivering, complete now in Christ, ready to join our servant team, and people applaud for them. It's a great celebration of victory in Christian work. It's weird because the church celebrates conversion by holding baptisms, which is biblical. That's good. Maybe we should also celebrate discipleship and the completion of the process. And that's exactly what our open sermon team meetings are when we invite the whole church in. We cancel all of our meetings and we really try to turn people out for this. And boy, people just come out of there saying, yeah, man, what a great church we're in. I'm going to be up there pretty soon. We should insist that our leaders lead in success and that they lead in failure. That's an aspect of discipline right there. We were stunned a few years back when some of our groups started to fail and we had to recombine them with other groups so we could reassimilate the people. And many of the leaders who were leading those groups were embittered by this, disillusioned, and said they would never lead again. Oh, no way! No. That's not how it works. We don't just tell the Lord, I'll lead as long as I can be successful. No worker has the right to say that. And we believe that God teaches us things through failure that He will never teach us through success. That every Christian leader is called into times of failure. The Bible, Paul says to Timothy, be ready in season and out. Out of season means there's no harvest then. And you're to be right there doing all you can during those times as well. So we now have begun to prepare our leaders very carefully and preach that you go forward for Christ, and if He calls you to go out there and fail for Him and be a fool for Him, then that you will serve in that capacity. Not to tell Him, I'll serve if the sun shines, but not if it's raining. No way! And that is an aspect, and boy, has this improved the toughness and the resilience of our leadership in this church. And we have scores of leaders who have gone out and failed flat on their face in leading a group, and they're back and leading another group now, and some of them have done it a couple or three times, and that's exactly the way it should be. It's exactly the way it should be. Everyone who's experienced in Christian work knows what it is to fail. And that is no excuse to go into a huff over God or pretend like He did something wrong. That is nothing but a learning experience that teaches us to depend on Him more and to find out where we went wrong and go back and try again. Today, every time we plant a home church in this church, we have a little celebration night where the new people that have become Christians since the last time we planted a home church give their testimony. And those who were doing nothing before, but during this cycle of our home church decided, I better become a servant of God because I'm needed here, give their testimony. And everybody celebrates. It's a time of happiness. And we tell them, this is such a great thing to be able to duplicate ourselves as a church. And all we have to do is just keep doing this, and we're going to reach thousands of people for Christ. And we also tell them, and by the way, this may very well fail. This might not work. And if it doesn't, we're going to bring our groups back together and we're going to try it again, another way. So that right from the beginning, that category is left in people's minds that Christian service includes times of failure as well as times of sweet victory and success. And that's all a part of it. This then is what it means in part. These are some of the ideas that come to mind in connection with holding our leaders in honor, in accountability, and in discipline. Let's go to a fourth idea. Every leader seeks to replicate. That's what we should preach, teach. That should be a settled knowledge for every single one of our leaders, is that, you know, I may not have done it yet, but I am on it. And I am striving toward the time when I will be able to help someone become a leader just like me. To promote this, leaders need to know their mission from day one. Before they're even leaders, they should be well aware this is what a Christian leader does. They duplicate themselves. We believe in a principle of multiplication or duplication. That's the basis of our ministry. And leaders just know this, and this is part of our training. Overseers who check in with home churches to see how things are going should ask this question first time, every time. Every interview, we want to know. So, let's talk about your upcoming leaders. What do you see? Who do you think is coming up? What are the barriers? What can be done about it? And what's your plan? We try to keep our leaders constantly thinking in these terms, never thinking in terms of preserving the status quo, always thinking in terms of duplicating themselves. Leaders need to understand how they're doing on this goal. Leaders need feedback, because it's easy, as you know, the weeks and months kind of run together and there's all these different crises coming up in our group and so on, it's easy to lose our focus on how are we doing on the main task of duplicating our leadership. Leaders need to understand how they're doing on this goal. Leaders need feedback, because it's easy, as you know, the weeks and months kind of run together and there's all these different crises coming up in our group and so on, it's easy to lose our focus on how are we doing on the main task of duplicating our leadership. We reach a point where the majority of the members of our church are planning to qualify as a leader. I think I can say with relative confidence that is the case in our church. I'm mainly, the last few years, focusing my attention on college ministry, and I know it's the case there, and what the over preponderant majority of people are assuming my day will come when I'm going to take my part as a contributor to in a leadership team. And I'm looking forward to that, and I'm working on it. That's why you'll see people are amazed when they come up. I am amazed. I come in up to the building here on a Wednesday night, and there will be 1,000 people going to classes and things like that. And the biggest reason is they're planning to be leaders, and they're working on it, and they love it. They do it quarter after quarter. Some of them way too many quarters after they've flunked the same class several times over. That's a lack of discipline. You need to fix that, because that just won't fly when you're serving the Lord. But, now think about this. Think about your church, and think about most of the people in your church thinking to themselves, well, I'm going to be a leader. Not next month, maybe not even next year, but I'm going to make it there. And I'm taking the steps right now. Do you think your church would move ahead if people felt that way? I tell you, it would move ahead. Yes, it would. And there's nothing at home church where everyone feels this way, where this is the consensus. Has it made in the shade? That home church is going to win. Yeah, this should be a goal. This should be an ethos in the leader-rich church, and your church will get rich in leaders if you have this understanding among your leadership. Fifth idea, top leadership sees helping, that is, helping our other leaders, as a primary goal. So most of our leaders, when we talk about 600 people leading here, most of them are tent makers. That is, they have careers and families, so they just lead, you know, with whatever time they can. And that's a hardship. It's hard to be a tent maker, even though it's a very noble calling, and that is probably the norm for Christian workers, is to be tent makers. A few of us are on staff, and we have been called to devote our full time to this project. We have to see that helping those people who are tent makers is a crucial mission for us. In our help, we should nurture strength in our leadership, not dependency. And that's a tricky thing there, because sometimes we want to help so much that we start to do the job for our leaders, and that creates weakness and dependency in our leadership. We have to think through all of the types of help that we want to give and ask ourselves, is this going to create strength and independence in our leaders, or is it going to make them depend on this in an unhealthy way? Our budget and our personnel allocation, again, should reflect the priority that we place on helping our leaders. And you can count it up. There should be a nice percentage going into oversight and assistance to home group leaders. All of our helpers should definitely be practitioners, no theoreticians. The last thing we need is somebody to come in with all kinds of super spiritual theories about leadership and start throwing those around and completely mislead the leaders that they're counseling. We want proven, we want church planters. That's what we want. Right? People that have planted multiple home churches are the ones that we consider heroes here. Those are people who have done something incredible, and those are the people we want to be counselors and helpers for our other leaders. Our classes that we offer are important. We believe in classes can do a lot of good. Academic knowledge, theological knowledge, is very slow to acquire at a high level. And so in any church, the scholars in that church are a resource. And one of the things you notice very quickly if you're a young leader out there trying to lead a group and you don't know too much is you feel like, man, I don't know what I'm doing here and I need more knowledge. I remember feeling that so acutely. And so we have people that have gone and they've gotten the knowledge, and that needs to be a shared resource for us, and we need to be able to, we can basically transmit a lot of academic knowledge to young disciples probably easier than their disciplers can. But the disciplers give them something that no class can give. They are right out in the front line of what's happening, watching the person interacting with other people, showing them what it means to live for God, to serve God, engaging in their deep relationship with them, seeing the personality and character flaws that are there and counseling them and helping them to get through those and win out over them. Teaching them ministry and the ways of God. That's where most of the leadership development happens. But I think the church can come alongside and assist here just with the classes. And that's why we have a pretty elaborate class system. Yes, helping our leaders. That's good. Number six, people know a clear pathway to leadership. It's possible to get into a position where people vaguely feel like, I kind of like would like to be a leader, but they don't have any clear sense of, you know, what do I do? And that malaise leads to a lack of motivation and a lack of action. Whereas if people can see the road goes right down there and I can see that what's at the end of it, they'll start to travel that road. They know specific expectations for leaders. They know what we want to see in a leader. They're given specific steps that they can take to improve themselves from where they're at now in the direction of leadership. And they receive feedback along the way on how are they doing. As they try their new wings out in really small types of servitude and leadership, you know, anytime we try to influence another person, we're really leading. Then they are receiving coaching and help from somebody that's right next to them and sees what they're doing and can help them with that. That would lead to a leader-rich church where I'm not having to sort all of this out and figure it out on my own. There are people that can do that and will do it. Gifted leaders can do that. But the Bible doesn't require that leaders be gifted. In fact, when we read Paul's criteria for leaders to Timothy and to Titus, the gift of leadership is not even an issue. It's never mentioned. It doesn't matter whether they're gifted to lead or not. That's because just like somebody that doesn't have the gift of evangelism can still witness, someone that doesn't have the gift of faith can certainly still pray, and people that don't have the gift of leadership can lead and do a very effective job too, particularly if the church is helping them get there. So there's a sixth idea. And that brings us to our last idea. This didn't take as long as we thought, did it? Leaders are formed into teams. Well, this is what we do, and it's not very widespread. In fact, very few churches that we've run across practice team leadership. Now, they may have a man and a wife as a team, a couple. Well, we don't consider that a team. We consider, you know, that in a marriage, a married couple tend to think together. And besides, if your accountability is just to your wife or husband, then it begins to confuse the marriage roles and so forth. Truly, we would like to have someone not involved in the marriage there as well. And probably a couple of people or even three. Most of our home churches are led by teams of four or five people. There is a New Testament pattern on this. Jesus always sent them out two by two. Even we see in every city, they appointed elders, plural, in each city, singular. Okay, well, that's eldership, plurality of eldership, definitely biblical. Peter says the elders should shepherd the flock of God amongst you. That should be something that's a corporate affair that's done together as a team. And we don't know exactly how the home church leadership, we know there were house churches in the early church, we don't know exactly how the leadership of those was set up, but I wouldn't be surprised if they had teams back then. Because that's just the way they thought. Even at the most extreme autonomous type of ministry, the apostle, the sent out one, so mature that they don't even need the church to account to, they can go out and blaze a new trail, they went out in groups. Oh yes, the missionary bands. Yeah. Paul didn't like to work alone. He wanted to work alone. I don't like to work alone. And so there is a New Testament pattern there that really makes perfect sense. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That's the definition of synergy. In team theory, a team, even though we may have four people that bring four different collections of gifting and capabilities into that team, the total of the team is greater than what we could expect from just those four people because of the dynamic of the team itself. The benefits of a team arrangement, the camaraderie that leaders feel with each other. Every one of us here that is a home church leader, at least the ones that aren't fighting with our fellow leaders right now, will sit here and think to ourselves, amen. Man, just imagine trying to lead this group by myself. I'm so glad that I have my colleagues, my fellow leaders, people that really understand what we're going through here and are going right through it with us together. That is a deep comfort to the leadership of our church. I believe that people would be dropping out of leadership right and left if we didn't have this. I can see why a lot of churches have trouble raising up leaders, because it's unappealing to stand up there by yourself and take all the shots that come at leaders. There's accountability in a team, something we believe in. We have a leader who's out of line or a leader who's doing something questionable. That leader is accountable to their fellow leaders and they will answer to them. Now, I believe that I need to be accountable. I don't like to go out and just make autonomous decisions for myself. I talk to all these people who are just like, you know, well, I just feel like the Lord wants me to do this. I just feel like the Lord's saying I should do that. That's not the way we operate in our church. I may feel like the Lord's saying such and so, so I take that to my brothers and sisters and I say, this is what I'm thinking. What do you think? And they're going to come back and say, you really didn't think about this part, did you? Yeah, that's the point. If they agree with me, sounds pretty good, then I know I can move ahead. And I feel a confidence there that I would never feel if I was doing it on my own. I believe that the Lord works this way. There's diversity in a team. And we believe that a group is better led by different types of people. That's why we don't need, you know, the classic leader type person to be a leader. You think of certain people as being dynamic leaders. Okay, we'll take them. But, you know, we need the other types of people. There may be a member of a leadership team who's a sensitive person, who's an inward person, who is a reflective person. And we believe that that is an input then that is going to make that leadership team more wholesome and better able to do their job as they become alert to problems that are happening in the church sooner than the others do. We may have people in that leadership team who are totally outward, jovial, all people all the time type people. And that brings a breath of freshness and a breath of excitement to that home church. We need that person in there. And we may have somebody in there who's a firm person, somebody who is a type A personality. And they may bring us the discipline that we need in this church. And they may be the one that's willing to make the hard call when the rest of us are kind of scared. So we believe that type of diversity in a leadership team is orchestrated by God. And that this is the way God wants to work with people. That's why we operate by teams. We forfeit growth because of this. Yes, we do. We know we could have faster multiplication of groups if we went to single leaders or single couples leading. Very many times we have a church that now says, we are full of people. We're ready to plant the church. Well, where's your leadership team? Well, we have one good leader. You know, we just don't have the others. So we have a one couple, but the other couple isn't quite ready. Oh, well, looks like you're going to be going over to a no-growth economy for a while. Be sure to let them know that any time would be fine to correct some of these problems. And the church is held back as it should be, really, if we're advancing more in terms of low-end work, evangelism and follow-up, than we are in terms of top-end work of maturity and leadership development. These should be kept in a rhythm with each other. And so we're willing to forfeit growth for the sake of being able to send out teams. The stability and the backup. Sometimes a leader falls. We lose a leader. Temporarily, maybe. Maybe they just got sick and they're incapacitated for the next 6 months. Good thing we have some other leaders behind them there, or we would be losing entire groups because of that. And then, too, you have those situations where one of our leaders has been masterfully attacked by the evil one, and they're smitten. Maybe they have problems in their marriage, and they've become unstable in their lives. They're really not that good anymore as leaders. Good thing they've got other leaders there to back them up and to see them through that, so we don't have to scrub our entire home church every time somebody starts to lose it. Teams are good. I don't know why more churches don't go with teams. I like it. Oh, here's one. Here's one right here. Exposure of key character issues in the leaders' lives. Some of us look so good as leaders until we have to lead with someone else. All of a sudden, there's all these problems. And that just peels back the blanket to show us the ego problems, the self-willed problems, the lack of humility there, and that's what God wants to uncover, and He can then get at that problem that we probably wouldn't even know was there if it wasn't for the fact we were on a team. I think teams are a great idea. Now, they have some dangers, too. It's not all good. They do probably slow our growth down, although you could argue that it might slow it down now. Maybe later. You know, if it leads to a stability in our church planting, if multiplication occurs and we aren't just pushing the dominoes on this side of the table to have them fall off the far side, you know, I don't know. It may be that we're going to do pretty good after all. With just a little bit more patience now, maybe we're going to see something much bigger later on. Oh, leaders' conflict. Now, that's a serious one. We want to talk about that one tonight. We're going to talk about that. That's a serious problem in a leadership team. That's what breaks up more of our teams than any other thing. As leaders fall into conflict with one another, it's a danger. I'm not prepared to give up teams in order to avoid this. I'd rather teach people how to manage conflict in a godly way. Of course, the confusion, it's so much easier for me to make decisions if I just decide what to do. I mean, I'm always right anyway. So now we get into a room full of people with all these different ideas, and you just start to think, oh man, these are pretty good ideas. I don't know anymore what to do. Well, and that confusion may not be such a bad thing. Of course, we can help. Here's where the central leader, leadership may be able to go out and give some counsel and help that team. And then, too, negative synergy could happen, where the negatives of our people are brought together and we suddenly wind up with more negativity than any of us would have had on our own. We need to talk about that, too. And we will talk about it as soon as we take a break. 15 minutes.